This podcast is brought to you by MyScore IQ. MyScore IQ services are here to help you be prepared when it comes to making big financial decisions, such as buying or refinancing your home or purchasing that new car. Try it out for only $1 for a 7-day trial. You'll receive your FICO scores from all three major credit bureaus, along with active credit report monitoring and alerts for changes to your credit report and possible suspicious activity.
MyScore IQ services can help you be in the best position possible when you take that step to apply for a home or auto loan, all for $1 for a 7-day trial. Visit MyScoreIQ.com/Todd to learn more. That's MyScoreIQ.com/Todd.
Welcome back to the Talking Stocks podcast. It's what we do. Joe and Todd with you here. Todd, how are you? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. It's sunny outside. It's a nice day.
Oh, it's beautiful outside.
You just said before the beginning of the show that your screen is green, so it's all good.
I have all green on my Fidelity terminal right now. It's a beautiful thing. Doesn't happen very often. It's a nice way to end off the week. I always love it when my Fridays are up days.
Yeah, it's been a brutal week, Joe. It's been like a tale of two tapes where you've had, you know, the NASDAQ and the S&P, and we've seen actually that for a little bit because of the mid to late cycle rotation. But this week has been really pronounced where you had a lot of high growth 2020 winners and early 21 winners, you know, the SPACs, pre-revenue names that really soared 100, 200, 300%. Dropping, like, you know, granite slabs were attached to their feet, you know, and the NASDAQ and the S&P kind of hanging tough. And I think, you know, actually, why don't we just, if you want, Joe, we could just jump right in and start sharing some screens.
Have at it.
All right. So I'm going to pull up my screen right now. Let's take a look at where we are right now in the QQQ and kind of give that demonstration of where the tale of two tapes has been. You've got, you know, the NASDAQ 100. As you can see, over the course of the last week or so, it had 2 weeks ago, broke the 21-day moving average, which is never a great thing, but the volume wasn't great. We had one day right here, a couple days after, we rebounded, tested that, bumped her head, Joe. Got a little bump of the noggin there on the 21-day. Yep. Came right down, sliced through that 50-day moving average. Found a little bit of footing yesterday, and today we're, like you said, seeing some green. Now let's contrast that to the S&P 500, where you've seen, you know, stable right along here. You also got that break of the 21-day. You never violated the 50-day, and you're trading a little bit back above the 21-day. Now, to take it one step further, Joe, let's take a look at some of these, you know, high-octane stocks that have been absolutely decimated. You know, one of the low scoring stocks in our research. And, you know, there's a number of these where I'm sure that some of our customers have walked away and been like, oh, I'm frustrated because your scores are so low. And there were times where I've looked at some of these scores too, Joe, in the last year and gone, why is that score so poorly? But, you know, scores are a good sidekick. They help keep you honest. And, you know, you look at a stock like Skills, where it peaked at $46 in February, it got as low as $12.19 yesterday, Joe. $12.19. It's just been a bloodbath. Another one, NanoX, NNOX, peaked at $94, Joe, in January. Got down below $20, $18.80 yesterday. Again, another low scoring stock in our research that I'm sure, you know, FinTwits was frustrated seeing these low scores. You know, I'm sure we probably lost a couple of subscribers over it. You know, I mean, it is what it is. And then you look at something like GoodRx, and it's kind of like the same thing where you just, you know, $60 in February and got all the way down to a low of $28 yesterday. So, and then, you know, I mean, the list, Joe, it goes on and on and on. But it really does point to the fact that, you know, hey, it's been this tale of two tapes. And, you know, I've got a theory, Joe.
What's your theory?
All right. So a lot of these stocks made huge moves in 2020. And what is due on, you know, May 17th or May 15th, Joe?
Taxes.
Taxes. So you got a whole bunch of people who may have like traded these things, made a lot of money, booked the gains, right? But then the market rolls over and now their tax bills due. Maybe they've gotten some margin calls. They don't have cash on the sidelines and they got to pay the bill. So what stocks are they selling? Maybe those high octane stocks, they're just getting forced out of them, or they got to sell them because they got to make their tax bill.
Right.
I don't know if that's true, but it certainly would explain why those are the stocks that have been really, really walloped while the rest of the market has hung relatively tough. And I don't know. I don't know where we go from here, but I will say that, you know, Joe, if you look at, and we had Jeffrey Hirsch on from Stock Traders Almanac a couple months ago, right? And, you know, we had an awesome conversation. So listeners, go back and check out that podcast because it was really, really good, packed with nuggets. And one of the things that we looked at was the post-election seasonality, I guess you'd call it, presidential cycles. And I wanna bring that up because if you look at, Joe, you know, I don't know if people are gonna be able to see this. Maybe I'll circle it a little bit, just make it a little bit easier. But you can see where I circled there, that's May. And you can see in the post-election years, that red line, Joe, sort of flattens out in May, mid-May kind of nosedives a little, and then re-exerts from there until, you know, usually you get strength in the NASDAQ a little bit longer than you do in the S&P up through, you know, the end of June before kind of that summer doldrums kicks in. So maybe, Joe, maybe, you know, hope springs eternal, that you have this combination of post-election year seasonal kind of dip in May and then rally, coinciding with this year's tax bill being pushed back a month to middle of month. And those two things allow for a nice rally into the end of the month. So we'll see. That's kind of how I'm modeling it right now.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. I mean, we've said it a couple times over the past several weeks now that the tech is really still pretty much at the bottom of the barrel as far as scores go as a sector, right, Todd? So, that'll creep back up as we get later into the cycle. But I personally, I'm looking at like industrials, consumer goods, and financials right now. It's just a lot easier to find good picks, and there are plenty more high scoring stocks to choose from, right?
Absolutely. And later in the show, we're going to do a smattering. So stay tuned, listeners, because I'm going to share with you the stocks that I've been buying and selling in the last week. And I think that it's going to reinforce a little bit of what Joe's saying, and that the goal here may not be to try to bottom fish 2020 winners, but instead look for those names that have held up better, and that they could be the ones they're setting themselves up on a launch pad. And, you know, one of the things, Joe, I love to listen to, you know, different people's take on things and kind of digest it all together. And, you know, I was watching a great podcast on Investors Business Daily the other day, this morning actually. And one of the stats that was thrown out there just sort of like really, wow, blew my mind, was that the average retreat, this goes back, you know, 50 years, you know, this isn't just based on 2000 data or last 20 years. If you look at the rule, what they call rule book winners, the stocks that have made the biggest gains, the biggest jumps, whatever, made you the most money. When they gave it up, when they rolled over and sold off, the average decline, Joe, any guess?
Oh, geez.
average decline of the last leaders of the last big run.
I'm gonna go with, and I'm gonna be so far off here, 15%.
72. 72% of their value lost.
At least I was right about being far off, right?
And that's on average. I mean, some of them do better, hold up better, and other ones get, you know, walloped more, right? And okay, so now the next question is, what percentage of those past leaders that get walloped end up being the leaders of the next run up?
Oh, it's got to be single digits. I'm going to be so far off again.
Now you're going the other way on your, 12%, but still not far from college. Not far from. So, I mean, if there's anything that point drives home to me, it's that you got to be paying attention. You've always got to be refreshing your watch list. Don't get married to these, oh, that was a great stock. It was 150. It's going to go back to 150 again. It may never go back to 150, people. There's nothing written in stone that says a stock has to go back to what it previously was traded at. So, it's a, selfish plug for a link below for a free trial to the sector research, the industry rotation ranking research, and the fact that we're always giving out fresh ideas that people can add to their watch list. But I think that really drives home the point that, keep an open mind to new ideas. Don't get yourself, stuck looking in the rearview mirror at, hey, these were great, great stocks earlier and they're going to be great stocks again.
I think a lot of people fall into that trap. I have myself in the past, and it's definitely just having a new way of getting new ideas that you haven't seen before in front of you is really beneficial. And I've certainly benefited from it myself. All right. So let's pivot. And we're going to do similarly to what we did last week. We're going to do another one of these live earnings read throughs. And so we've selected two different stocks again. Todd, you have not read through either of these. Is that fair to say? Either of these shareholder letters?
I'm stoked that we're doing this again this week. That was a lot of fun last week. Hopefully listeners liked it. If you want us to keep doing these things, drop a note in the comments, and that way we know, okay, this is what people want to hear. We'll continue to do it. But I thought it was a lot of fun. So I have not, Joe. I haven't
Neither
looked
have
at either of these press releases. I have no idea if these, I know nothing.
Yeah. So we're going to look at Airbnb and we're going to look at Coinbase. So let me screen share here and we'll start with Airbnb. How's that?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right. Bring it on. All right. So I did hear just a little bit about this. I obviously, their numbers generally are still much below 2020 or pre-2020 levels, but their bookings up slightly, still not a lot, but I think the impression is they're going to dig themselves out of that hole pretty quickly. Personally, I'll believe it when I see it. They are still far from being profitable, as I think we all know.
I'm looking at this list. One of the first things that jumps out to me, and listeners, we do post these to YouTube. If you want to follow along YouTube when you get home, pull us up, Lyman Alpha Talking Stocks on YouTube, and you can follow along with what we're looking at on the screen. And, one of the things that jumps out to me here, Joe, is that they don't put revenue as the first line item. No. They're putting it as nights and experience book at the top, followed by gross booking value, then revenue, and then of course last loss, right? So this is what we want you to focus on up here, this nights and experiences booked. And I don't mind double digits, 13% year over year. I'm actually a little surprised it's not stronger. I mean,
me too.
You can't tell me that, okay, so year over year, well, it was the first quarter, so maybe you had some strength in the January, February before people really started to wake up to the COVID shutdown. So maybe what you'll see, Joe, is a huge acceleration in the Q2 numbers.
Yeah.
Because maybe
I would think so, just because judging by what happened last year, I remember college spring break and, just generally school vacations up until I feel like the end of March about weren't really affected. I remember people were still on vacation as everything was kind of shutting down. And so I think that if people had something booked, at least up until the end of March, probably, which would be the end of the first quarter, right, that it probably was not affected all that much. So yeah, I guess that makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I think we'll see a huge year over year jump in bookings in Q2.
And not to say that we'll see a huge year over year jump in this net loss turning into a profit or anything down here. I'm very skeptical of that myself.
Well, let's dig into it some more here. Okay. So we had, the nights and experience books were 64.4 million. That's up 13% year over year. The gross booking value. Okay. So how much of those nights booked, what's the value of that? That 10.3 billion, that's up 52% year over year, which is interesting to me. Maybe there's some slightly higher prices,
or it could be people going for longer periods of time.
Or upgrading because they've got a little extra money in their pockets and
a nice little stimulus check, or just, you know, they've been working from home and haven't been incurring a lot of costs. Certainly possible.
And then you see that revenue, Q1 2021 revenue was up 5% year over year to 887 million, up 3% on constant currency basis, which simply means that they're adjusting out any, because they do, you can book Airbnbs anywhere in the world. So adjusting for currency was up 3% year over year, if it was constant currency, and 5% year over year if you don't adjust for the currency impacts. So yeah, okay. So more people booking than they did last year, a significantly higher gross booking value. And then the revenue up slightly, but like you and I just talked about, the Q1 comparison maybe isn't nearly as weak as the Q2 comparison might be. And then that big, you've mentioned already, kind of hinted at it, that big net loss, 1.17 billion in the first quarter. Although it looks like 380 million of it was related to the repayment of debt, which is never a bad thing. 292 million non-cash mark-to-market adjustment for warrants, and 113 million expense related to lease no longer deemed necessary. So there are a lot of one-time items in that 1.2 billion loss. All right, what else we got here? If you scroll down.
Sure.
So adjusted EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, deductions, amortization, loss of 59 million. But that they say that was materially improved from a year ago, although they don't give us the year ago number here. But they do say it's at the end of the letter. We'll get to it. Okay.
All right. So, yeah, 2020 was a year none of us will ever forget. Yeah, we get it. Cliches. All right. So this is basically just what we were looking at before with a little bit more
detail. Go scroll
up
a little bit, though. Right there, man, this is what we were talking about. This revenue increase is driven by strength in North America and higher average daily rates during the quarter.
Interesting. So, I wonder why that is.
That's interesting. So, you know, maybe this just people have more pricing power now. Be interesting to see how much capacity is actually open. I know it's really tough. I tried to book something for the summer. It's really hard to find what I'm looking for.
Yeah, now I know the summer is just supposed to be insane. We have some pretty touristy areas near where we are in New Hampshire, and I know they're expecting record-breaking numbers this year.
And then if Joe, look at that next line, where it says significant items impacted Q1 21 net loss. That we were just talking about that. So that net loss, the headline number is scary, but 782 million of that 1.17 billion are theoretically non-recurring or one-time things.
Yep.
And here's the comparison that I wanted in the adjusted EBITDA.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a pretty marked improvement.
That is quite the improvement. 59 million from a loss. So loss of 59 million up from a loss of 334 million in Q1 of 2020. So that's significant.
Increased marketing efficiency. That means that they're just spent less on marketing. and maybe targeting is getting better. But yeah. I mean, let's put it this way, Joe. I mean, how much does Airbnb really have to market right now? I mean, if you're looking for a place to go, it's going to be one of the top three places you pull up to look.
Yeah.
Without any kind of prompting from click on this button.
Yeah, I don't think there's really any brand awareness they have to do anymore. So it's just a matter of making sure that they remain at the top of search results when somebody's looking for rentals in wherever.
You know, so, I'm scrolling down, and to your point you made earlier where people are staying longer.
Yep.
Look at that third bullet point under business highlights.
Yep.
Guests aren't just traveling on Airbnb, they're living on Airbnb.
Not for traditional travel, but for long-term stays defined as stays of 28 days or more.
24, so nearly a quarter of all bookings are long-term.
That's impressive. It makes sense though, right? Because with all of these, I guess they're becoming less and less now, but over the past year, all of these quarantine restrictions, right? And so if you're traveling, like if you were traveling from New Hampshire to, I don't know, Virginia, you would have to quarantine in Virginia for 2 weeks. And so if you're quarantining there, you can't really go out and do much while you're quarantining, assuming you're doing it right, which obviously most people don't, but you know, if you want to play by the rules, then yeah, you have to stay down there for at least 2 weeks in order to, you know, kind of be able to experience the area you're in, right?
I'll take it one step further too, Joe. I mean, with work from home, I mean, look at what we do. We could be anywhere.
Right.
I mean, we've recorded podcasts with you at ski lodges and you down in South. So you could do a long-term rental in someplace awesome. You know, I don't know whether or not though, post-vaccination, that number starts to come down. I would imagine it would.
I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although who knows, maybe people who have enough disposable income where they can do that, they decide that they're going to go up. If they're in New York City, they decide that they're going to go up to Maine for the whole summer or something. Right. If they can continue to work from home, the only thing they need is a steady internet connection.
Yeah, true. And, you know, I've talked to my wife about it and, you know, we were like, you know, I can work from anywhere. So why can't we get on a plane? Well, we can't because Europe won't have us right now. But I mean, theoretically, we could go to Ireland,
right?
Rent a place for a month and hang out in Ireland and, you know, really embed ourselves. And honestly, if I had my druthers, that's what I would love to embed myself. You know, forget this 3-day, 5-day travel or 7-day travel where you takes your first 2 or 3 days just to get it acclimated. And your last 2 days, you're like all worried about when you're coming home, you know? I mean, it's like.
Yeah, it could just be the new way, assuming you can afford that. And
that number's, how many people can afford to do? So that number's probably going to fall.
I would imagine, but who knows? If that stays at 10 to 15%, that's still significant, right?
No, it certainly gives you pricing power because you're taking capacity out of the system.
Right.
You know, okay, so what else we have? That's just blah, 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 blah. We're all just, we're awesome. We're ready for you. educating the world about what makes air. Okay, so 2021 plan. Educating the world about Airbnb's difference, recruiting hosts and setting them up, simplifying journey, delivering world, blah, blah, blah. That's what you'd expect them to say, right?
Right.
We're going to grow our business.
Special announcement. Most comprehensive update to Airbnb service in 12 years. All right. That's completely non-informative.
Yeah, that doesn't tell as much as a shareholder.
Yeah, I think we're getting to
this is a lot of
portion of this.
Yeah, a lot of marketing
stuff
here. 55% of hosts are women. 58% of super hosts are women. I wonder if they give us a number of how many hosts there are. They say?
I'm sure they do somewhere.
I think someone on Twitter said that there's like 4 million hosts or something. I could be totally wrong.
I bet I can just Google it. Let me just Google it.
Yeah.
How many Airbnb hosts are there? 2.9 million in 2019.
Okay, so yeah, 4 million wouldn't be a bad guesstimate. Yep. And if you think about it, I mean, there's way more than 4 million households on the planet. So
oh yeah.
There's probably a lot of people here who aren't and but maybe could still be consider
Yeah, I mean, I live in a neighborhood where a lot of people's homes are either seasonal or they're, you know, second homes, vacation homes, or even just straight up vacation rentals. And a lot of the time, those, in fact, the house across the street from me, the lady only lives here 5 to 6 months out of the year, and the rest of the year she's in Florida. So that's an untapped market. Nope, house is completely empty.
Yeah, so I mean, that's just money just waiting to be tapped. And I'm sure right. There's a lot of people, maybe during the COVID too. I mean, people didn't want to do that. They were resistant to it because they didn't want to have a whole bunch of strangers walking through their house, right? But, you know, we get to a point post-COVID, maybe we'll start to see that open up. And that obviously would, you know, that could be good.
Absolutely.
All right, what else do we see in here? Anything else that we should talk about?
Let's see.
Let's get down to the nitty gritty. Let's see if they have
service
tables.
This is, we already had these numbers.
Kind of what we just talked about with those gross booking value numbers and everything else. North America's strongest region. Seems like.
That makes sense because we didn't really have lockdowns all that much.
Yeah. And if you look at Europe and yeah, they're shouting out a couple different places and where pandemic is still raging. And they're not nearly as far along in vaccination as we are. So that could remain a drag for a little while longer. And then what else do we see here?
Domestic travel strong in Mexico and Brazil. We know that the vaccination rates in even the developed countries in Asia is very, very slow.
Yeah, India especially still got a huge problem.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you keep going down, let's see if we can get to. Okay,
so here we saw those numbers.
1.1. And there's significant items we already talked about.
Yep.
So basically what they're just saying is, hey, okay, we're making headway. So Q1 of 2019. Oh, that's an interesting comparison. This chart right here, Joe, at the top.
Yeah.
You know, if you compare to pre-COVID, Q1 revenue was $887 million versus $839 million in Q1 2019. That's instructive.
That's surprising to me. Oh, this next chart is brutal.
Yeah, but again, it's that you got to subtract $782 million of that as potentially one-time events.
So yeah, it's more than 2019.
Yeah, losing money.
Yeah,
no question.
Absolutely. EBITDA, significant improvement though.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else you think we can?
No, I think we can probably pivot. Let me just look at real quick. So the revenue of $87 million, that was a beat. Street was looking for 107. That beat the street by $172 million. And then probably not surprisingly, the EPS missed.
Yep.
Because again, you had all those one-time items, some of which weren't forecast and weren't built into analyst models.
Right.
All right. So beat on the top line, missed on the bottom line, and revenue is good, but losses, they still have some work to go before we can say they're profitable.
All right. Yep. All right. Coinbase time. You ready?
Yeah, let's take a look at Coinbase and see what we see.
Let's do it. This should be a fun one. All right. This is a little hard to read here. Zoom in a little.
All right. So, and again, listeners, we're pulling what we're doing is pulling up just the press releases. We're going to the investor relations website of the companies, pulling up their press releases and just going through it. And again, we're just doing it for the first time. We're just looking through it to see what we see and see what jumps out at us. And one thing that jumps out to me there, Joe, is Coinbase's verified users.
That's there's a lot jumping out here to me.
56 million verified users. That's up by 13 million additional users just quarter over quarter. In Q1 2020, 34 million. So 34 million to 56 million verified users.
That's amazing.
Look at
monthly
the
transacting
volume.
Users, trading volume, everything here is just off the charts.
You tell our listeners what those numbers are, Joe.
Yeah, so monthly transacting users, this is just from the previous quarter to this quarter. So Q4 2020, monthly transacting users, I assume that means users who have made a trade in the past month, went from 2.8 million to 6.1 million. Trading volume in billions of dollars went from 89 to 335.
This is quarter over quarter, people.
Yes. And assets on platform went from 90 billion to 223 billion. I'm just going to keep reading these off because they're pretty amazing. Net revenue goes from 497 million to 1,597,000,000. Total revenue went from 585 million to 1.8 billion. Net income went from 177 million to 771 million.
That's a
reverse
over
of
quarter.
Itself. Yes, this is quarter over quarter. This is not year over year, folks. And then adjusted EBITDA went from 288 million to 1.117 billion.
Wow.
That's
all right. So more users, more transactions, more assets on the platform, lots more revenue, tons of leverage, operating leverage here. The net income jump year over year, 32 million.
My gosh.
To 771 million. So there's not a lot of costs associated with each additional transaction on the part of Coinbase.
Right.
Is kind of the takeaway there.
One of the things that I find really interesting is that the trading volume is over 100 billion higher than the assets on the platform, which is to say that the people who are these monthly transacting users are like really, really active. They're making several trades a month.
Yeah, I also wonder too though, Joe, if that's telling us that other people are using Coinbase for the transactions, but they have vaults that are custodying the assets somewhere else.
So that I don't know.
Rather than holding it at Coinbase, you've got the trading volume, but you've got a number of people who have their own vaults and they're shifting those coins off of Coinbase. They're just using it as their broker to trade. So either way, interesting.
Yeah. All right. We'll keep going down here. So, oh my gosh. Retail trading volume, or really both of them, but
but I'm more interested in that institutional volume, Joe.
Yeah,
because one of the big knocks on Coinbase has been, yeah, well, it's getting all of its revenue from, you know, transaction fees on retail investors.
What you can happens see here, that's not true.
It certainly seems like institutional is definitely becoming a bigger piece of the pie, at least by trading volume.
Yeah. So it's for those of you who are listening, the institutional trading volume is about 2/3 of the overall trading volume. So that went from 57 billion in Q4 of 2020 to 215 billion in Q1 of 21. And retail trading volume went from 32 billion to 120 billion. Again, this is quarter over quarter. I just want to make that abundantly clear.
Right. And it looks like, reading a little further here, it looks like 60% of all the volume was either Bitcoin or Ethereum. Remember, Coinbase does not trade Dogecoin yet. I did see some things on Twitter that would make me think that maybe they're considering it. I think the rumor was something like 4 to 6 weeks. I mean, Gemini, one of their big competitors that's not publicly traded yet, is allowing Dogecoin. What's interesting here, Joe, too, I mean, still we've got all this trading volume. And selling is trading volume too, right? But this week we did have a pretty sharp sell-off across the board in Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, Dogecoin, you name it. When Elon Musk, the Doge father, came out and said, you know what? I know we said a couple months ago, we're going to start allowing you to pay for Teslas with Bitcoin, but we're not going to do that anymore because, you know, we're afraid of how much, or we don't like how much energy is consumed in creating Bitcoin and validating transactions and all that jazz. So everything swooned. I mean, you had people just pressing the sell button left and right. These things were down 20, 30% in the span of a few hours. Then we did see, I mean, this is what you can't, is your conviction your own conviction or is it borrowed conviction, right? And, you know, so you got a whole bunch of people sold. And then sure enough, day or two later, you got him coming out again saying, oh, by the way, you know, we're working with Dogecoin developers to see if that could be a new transaction medium because it uses less energy. So it may just be that, you know, this is the normal seesawing of it, but it will be interesting to see over time what happens with transaction volumes. You know, I mean, if people lose a lot of money and they get wiped out in crypto, obviously transaction volumes is going to fall, right? And with it, revenue and all that profitability we saw.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if this volume spike is sustainable looking, if we're looking at this at their Q4 report. I almost get the feeling that it's gonna look like a spike if we were to graph it out. But I mean, there are still experts across the board saying that Bitcoin's gonna get to six figures this summer, which obviously implies heavy volume. So I don't know at this point. I'm just kind of saying it's hard telling, not knowing.
Exactly. I mean, you can't, it's almost like this is a true price discovery trade, right? It's whatever the trend happens to be. But you just, listeners, you know, I do a crypto experiment. I did not sell anything at all this week on that news from Elon Musk. Okay, so just getting back here, I just want to have that little tangent there because you have to consider what trading volumes may look like going forward because that's how they make a lot of their money.
Right.
So, and look at that next chart, the next table they have there, assets on the platform. So that's a huge jump in institutional assets on the platform.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my assumption that any revenue off of that, though, is less for institutions than retailers per user. So it's less valuable to the bottom line, probably. But still, institutional dollars are more sticky than retail dollars historically for brokerages. So it's good to see that.
Yeah. And then the next part of this chart just breaks down the percentage of assets on the platform. So overwhelmingly Bitcoin, as you'd expect, 62%, but that's actually down from 70% in Q4 of 2020. And then other crypto assets went from 13% in Q4 2020 to 21% in this quarter.
It seems like it bounces around a lot.
It does. Yeah. 15, 18, 23, 13, 21. Yeah. For those of you
maybe
listening.
Maybe that has to do with, you know, whenever they release a new coin or whether or not the stock cryptos are running or not, or Bitcoin's running or not. Or...
Yeah. And there have been some crypto fads too. Like Ripple was one that kind of came and went. There's this other one, Cardano coin, that I don't know if you've heard of that one. It's an interesting one that kind of comes and goes in a bit of a trend cycle, and some other ones too. Bitcoin Cash you could throw in there as well. So we'll just keep cruising down this shareholder letter.
So this is what I was talking about, Joe, with that institutional accounting for because of course you get to give a deal to the institutions relative to retail, and now you're seeing that in the transaction revenue in that table you're seeing for net revenue.
Yep.
So a lot more assets, but look at the lot less money being generated by them
Yeah, that's a huge discrepancy. But I think that like it's still, you still can't overlook the importance of having institutions on there, because in my opinion, it gives some more validity to the platform rather than just having a bunch of, you know, meme lords trading Dogecoin and, you know, posting about their memes on social media. To actually have some financial institutions on the platform trading, holding, and not leaving, most importantly, it definitely makes it more legitimate in my
opinion. And Joe, I've seen a number of different companies of money managers are now saying, hey, I'm creating an LP, or we're investigating setting up an LP, you know, version or for crypto. And so my assumption is that we were going to see more of that, not less of that.
Yeah, I agree.
And then, but it's also interesting too, I mean, the transaction revenue, again, we talked about that being a big knock, how reliant they are on the retail transaction volume. So, I mean, think of their total revenue was what, 1.8, or what was it? 1.8 billion for the first quarter, of which 1.45 billion of that was retail, right?
Yeah.
But then you say, okay, well, can they make money on other stuff? And my argument is probably yes. We haven't even seen.
Yeah. That. So they have this subscription and services revenue, which was only 56 million in the most recent quarter.
But look where it was a year ago.
Yeah, it was at 7.1 million a year ago.
So definitely seeing some pretty tremendous growth there, even though it's still a very small sliver.
Yeah.
Small sliver of their overall revenue pie.
All right, Todd, I'm just going to keep scrolling through here. Stop me if something catches your eye.
Yeah, just keep going. I think operating expenses be interesting. Q1, 813 million. Transaction expenses were largest. Yeah, 49 million percent of revenue, but they fell. They have 15%. 15% of revenue went to transaction expenses, which really isn't that much.
No, it's not.
12% went to technology and development. Only 7% went to sales and marketing, which is interesting. 8% to general administrative. I love seeing general and administrative fall as a percentage of revenue.
And that plummeted 20% in Q4 of 2020. And now it's 8%.
Just as an aside with any company listeners, I don't care if sales and marketing stays constant or even increases alongside revenue, because you know you're going to make, you know, you're get out there and get the name out there to take advantage of the opportunity. But the general administrative, now you're talking about fixed expenses, kind of, you know, it's the people who are doing the back office work within the organization, right? If you can grow that much at a much slower rate, then you've got tons of operating profit margin optionality,
right?
In my view. So going from, you know, 33% of revenue to 8% of revenue, a lot of that obviously being driven by the huge jump in revenue. That's, to me, that's still pretty good sign. I like
Todd,
that.
What's your take on this technology and development, which I assume is their way of saying R&D, that expense is really going down quite a lot.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, you have to invest obviously in innovation, but the amount that you invest in innovation, I mean, that's honestly, Joe, it's on a dollar terms amount. They look how much they spent.
Yeah. So as a
4 million. So
listeners,
really,
as a raw number, it's gone from 90 million in Q4 to 184 million in Q1. But when I see that going from 18% of net revenue down to 12%,
it's perfect. I like it, Joe.
You like it?
I like it. This is why
it makes me a little nervous.
But they doubled their spending on on innovation, you know, technology and development. They doubled it. So, I mean, at some point, as you're growing very rapidly like this, you're going to see that happen. So they basically, Joe, is the best of both worlds, in my view. They're still plowing tons of money way more than they were a year ago, 47 million to 184 million, into making the infrastructure better. But because revenue has grown so much more dramatically, it's just a smaller, it's a smaller percent. So I personally, I don't have a problem with it.
Pretty impressive too, that they only have 1700 full-time employees.
Yeah. Yep.
For a company, at least of their market cap, that's pretty much unheard of.
Yeah. Let me pull up now just to see how do those numbers compare.
Sure, I'll
to
stop
what people
my share.
Were looking for. And I'm just gonna go really quickly and look at Seeking Alpha. Interesting enough, on a gap, they missed on both.
Wow.
Not by a lot, kind of a rounding error on the top line, 1.8 billion versus they wanted 20 million more than that. The GAAP EPS was 305 per share. They say that was a miss of 23 cents. That's just, I'm just reading this off of Seeking Alpha's, assuming this is right. But I mean, expectations, Joe, maybe we're just really, really ratcheted high because it was no mystery that, you know, cryptos were something that was hot, that a lot of people were excited to be taking part in.
Yeah, I think for all intents and purposes, it's safe to say that they met those expectations. I mean, yeah, technically they were a couple $1 million off, but in the grand scheme of things, I was pretty impressed with that report. And certainly, I mean, obviously I have Coinbase on a watch list, but it's gonna go on a close watch list starting next week. So it'll be interesting to see what it does.
Well, I think Joe, this might be a good time to swap to the smattering and me talking
about
some of my buys and sells, because I added to my Coinbase position this week, and like a dope, complete rookie mistake. Oh my God, how long have I been at this? I didn't realize when I bought on that they were reporting.
Oh, so that is a rookie
right
mistake
in front,
Todd,
of the report, which is just such a dumb move.
Didn't I just publish the short to why not to buy a stock before earnings?
Right.
Come on, Todd.
I mean, complete rookie mistake. So it just goes to show you that we all make them, listeners, and it's okay. So why don't I pull up my screen? And like I said, I had already had a position in it. So I really just was averaging down on it. And you can see that we're down about 3% today. We had that, you know, crazy launch. We talked about that. We talked about it holding the 250 reference price last week, rallying back up and then trading down and then almost touching that 250 reference again. So that's why I added a little bit more there. Typically speaking, IPOs usually undercut, I think 80% within the first 9 months of trading. So you can be patient when it comes to IPOs. You know, another one that I completely bumbled and I added to this week was Bumble, BMBL. You know, you see how, you know, you traded down from the IPO launch. You broke that support. I was hoping it would hold it. And then you just nosedived. You're up 4% today. So my buy yesterday on that big steep drop working out a little bit for me today, but I'm still underwater on that. And with IPOs, again, you can be patient. And these are all for me, again, as a reminder, if you're a new listener, these are all very small. I own a lot of stocks. So, you know, these are all 1% or less positions right now that I'm
Todd,
talking
how many,
about.
How many stocks do you own these days approximately? Is it still over 100?
Yeah.
Yeah.
128. I know. Stupid amount. And then I cut back a bunch. And then I've started again on the weakness this week. I started to pick up some stuff on sale. Those are two that I had already owned, Bumble and Coin, that I added just a little bit more to, because I do believe in those businesses. So I bought those more on story than anything else, which you can run into risk in the short term is with negative sentiment, but I wanted to make that disclaimer. This next stock, however, is one that I've wanted to own for a long time, Shockwave. And they're involved in helping people who, you know, have jammed up arteries because, you know, they're at risk of having a stroke because of the jammed up arteries. And this is a newer, better way, theoretically, of breaking up the calcification within those arteries that could be safer. And people are embracing it. Revenue grew 110% year over year to $32 million. 2022 estimates now call for it moving to a profit. And, you know, you can see it break out on the news of the earnings report, Joe, here. I took it the next day on that down. And the listeners, this is what I love to do. This is a high scoring stock in a research. I think it's got a score like a 90, 95, something like that. Came off of its high, undercut its 21 day moving average, held the 50, closed above the 21 day moving average, and then retested the 21 day moving average. That's when we talk about how I like to buy on down days. And I like to buy at support levels. Oftentimes, I'll use the 21-day, the 50-day, and the 200-day moving average as my points where I'll do that. I also bought some Cleveland Cliffs, CLF. You can see that's a little down today, but it's still above its 21-day. Again, I'm buying it as it broke out and now is retreating back towards that 21-day moving average. Same space, roughly, Freeport-McMoRan. So again, copper, steel, gold, et cetera, related play, broke out to new highs, retreating now back towards the 21-day moving average. So I'm using this retreat as my opportunity to get exposure to that space. And then another one that I picked up was Natera. And Natera is another one of the DNA developing genetic tests to help people, you know, be able to determine treatment and the like. This is a company that's growing pretty quickly, 62% year over year growth in the first quarter to 152 million, still losing a lot of money, but I picked it up, Joe, right there as it's testing and recovering the 200 day moving average with the idea that, you know what, if it breaks below this 83.19, I'll admit I was wrong, or I'll go back and redo my homework and make sure that I truly, truly believe that that this stock is one that I want to hold on to long term. I am a fan, just generally speaking, of genomics and especially genetic testing, because I really do believe that's a multi-billion dollar long-term opportunity. Swapping over quickly, Joe, we'll do a few of the sells so people can see when I sell and why I sell. I unloaded my shares in ResMed, which you can see had this big gap down drop after earnings below the 200-day moving average. It bumped up to the 200-day moving average, retreated again, bumping up again. I may regret this one, Joe, because you do have a gap that theoretically could fill. But honestly, I think this is a kind of a prove it to me now stock for me. I want to see this thing actually recover that. And if it does, then I'll consider rebuying it. But the fact that year over year sales were flat, there was no growth there. I was expecting better than that. And I typically, as a growth investor, don't like to own these companies with decelerating revenue. So that was one of the reasons that I unloaded that one. I also sold shares in Castle Biosciences, because it had broken the 200-day moving average, has a declining 21-day and 50-day now. They're about to cross over the 200-day moving average. You've got a big up day today, up 11%, but it's still below all those levels. More than happy to walk away. I made some money on it and walk away, and just I'll reevaluate it if it recovers and rebuilds in our scores. Curiosity Stream is one where I bailed out and it has worked. I sold that last Friday prior to the earnings report when it was trading somewhere around $12. We're now at $9.23. Yesterday, we got down to $8.33. Again, rolling over 50-day, rolling over 21-day moving average. Both of them going to intersect the 200-day moving average. Just again, stocks got to prove it to me from here for me to want to buy it back. Another sale was EXP World Holdings. This is part of that whole shift to digital real estate, broke the 200-day moving average, despite huge revenue growth. 21-day is now below the 200-day moving average, 50-day rolling down. I just don't want to be anywhere near it, Joe, right now while it tries to figure out where it's going. And then the last one I would just mention is Trade Desk, which I got lucky and sold here last Friday on this up bar. You can see here, I had bought this, Joe, in February and March, down around these areas, thinking it would hold the 200-day moving average. It broke the 200-day moving average. The volume in it was rising. It just was one of those situations where I looked at it and said, you know what? I'm going to use the next move up towards that resist, towards that, you know, which is now resistance, prior support, unload it. And sure enough, I dodged a bullet because the stock got clobbered down 25% after it reported earnings. So, I mean, that just gives investors a little bit of a inside baseball to my brain of some of the things I was looking at. So there were a couple IPO buys that I believe in the story that I averaged down on. I may regret it, but we'll see what happens. And then on the sell side, breaking below the 200-day moving average, I just don't like to own stocks that are broken like that. And oftentimes you'll get a little relief rally back up towards that resistance. You can use that to unwind, go flat, and then you can take it with a fresh set of eyes from there.
There you go. I think that's a great way to wrap up for the week. As always, we appreciate your comments, both the supportive kind and the inquisitive kind. We love to hear from our viewers and listeners. And so if you have any questions you'd like us to address in future episodes, you know how to reach us. YouTube comments, at us on Twitter. We're happy to answer your questions. So I think we'll leave it there. Have a great weekend, everybody.